About 10 years ago, my 91-year-old Aunt Evie died, and I was asked to do a eulogy at her funeral service. And I thought hard about it because it was really important for me to help this little Lutheran community understand how important they and the whole congregation, they as individuals and the whole congregation were to her. She had grown up her entire life across the alley, literally, from this church. And even in her older years, spent days, like an hour a day, she'd pack a little lunch to go in there and help them out. So I wanted this congregation to understand that. And since she was 91, most of the people that were her Sunday school teachers and her peers had already died. And so it was important for me to tell the story of her life so that they could get that connection. So I want to share a little bit of that story with you today. And it doesn't actually begin with my Aunt Evie. It begins with my grandmother, who I've never met. It was my aunt and my mother's mother. So she was born in 1899, and it's in northern Illinois in Big Rich farm country. She was the one of eight children, six boys and two girls. And as was the tradition, the boys were expected to be able to inherit all the farmland that the grandparents had accumulated, but the girls weren't. And so they had to find spouses, of course, from adjacent farms to be able to continue on in this part of the world. And so essentially, there was sort of an arranged marriage, I was told, and it was not a particularly loving one, is what my mother told me years later. And then to add insult to injury, the father died suddenly when my mother was four and my aunt was six, because it was really, really cold one November when he was out harvesting, caught pneumonia, and just died. And then within 18 months or 2 years, the Great Depression hit, and they lost the farm, and they moved into this tiny little house in this little town in northern Illinois. And they pretty much lived off the charity of their relatives. I would say that they were poor, but not homeless. Now, my grandmother never worked outside of the home. Maybe that's a modern concept. Maybe in the Depression there were no jobs. Maybe it just wasn't done. So at 16, 10 years later, my aunt dropped out of high school so that she could go work at the grocery store to get a little bit of income coming into the family, so that my mother could continue on in high school and graduate. And then when my mother graduated 2 years later, went out to work, my aunt went back to school so that she could finish her high school degree. Well, while all of this shuffling with high school was going on, it was the beginning of World War II. So Hitler and the Nazis had come to power in Germany, and they had already had the takeover of Czechoslovakia and Austria, the invasion of Poland. And then Japan was being very aggressive in the Pacific, and ultimately Pearl Harbor happened. So all of this, it's hard for us to imagine in this day and age, all of this chaos was happening when my aunt and my mother were in their late teens and early 20s. They went off and worked in factories to support the war effort, and they took care of their aging mother. And I do that in air quotes because my grandmother was only in her 40s at this point, but was rumored, my mother told me later, to suffer from undiagnosed mental illness and depression, which probably led to a lot of a variety of physical ailments. So my grandmother died suddenly in her mid-50s in 1953. And only then, in their early 30s, did my mother and my aunt actually begin to live independent lives. So my point is that they grew up in this time of great chaos and uncertainty. And although neither my mother or my aunt seemed to, they weren't paranoid, they didn't seem to live their lives in fear, I do believe that they thought the world was a very fearful place. They needed a faith full of unwavering certainty that a God of righteousness was going to win over the devil and all the forces of evil in their world. They needed a faith that promised an eternity free from suffering in the next life, if not this one. And that little Lutheran church and those ministers that they had and that congregation provided that. So I was giving this eulogy, I think it must have been my first semester in seminary. And I thought I was so clever to think about this concept that your worldview influences your faith. And well, soon I learned that others had thought of that concept before me. And today, I'm going to talk about one of those people. It's the Reverend Daniel Cantor. He wrote this little book called Faith for the Unbelievers. He's the senior minister at First Unitarian Church of Dallas, Texas. And this is an excerpt from his book. What is faith? When we get right down to it, it's pretty clear we don't know. But it's often taken to mean strong religious feelings or a devout belief in something unprovable. If the only people who had faith were those who devoutly believed in unprovable religious concepts, many of us would be left out of the conversation. To go beyond these superficial definitions, we must move past purely traditional religious ideas and consider things that we practice every day, but that are rarely given much attention. Reverend Cantor goes on, more than an adherence to a belief system, faith is an orientation to life. It is looking out at the world from a particular perspective and using that perspective to consider the meaning of our existence. Now, in this very small book, it actually only contains 5 chapters, one on beliefs, one on trust, one on loyalties, one on worldview, and then he sums it all up in a chapter called Becoming Faithful. So a few months ago, Reverend Christina and I decided we would split the chapters between us and create a 2-part sermon series. So next week, tune in for the sequel. Reverend Christina will be diving into guiding beliefs and areas of trust, the first 2 chapters, while today I spend my time on the concept of worldview and just touch a little bit on loyalty. So briefly, Cantor cites that there are 3 traditional worldviews of Christianity. Now, he uses Christianity because the dominant cultural point of reference in our society here is Christianity. So the first worldview is evil. The world is inherently evil and trying to take over. The narrative here is that everything is a battle, or maybe like a giant chess game, between Christ and, I guess I'd call him his evil brother, Satan. And we're just the pawns in this chess game. That was the worldview of my mother and my aunt. It promotes fear of everything, even God. It requires forces of good to constantly counteract the evildoers. And then the believers need to separate from the evildoers to protect themselves. It's very much a religion of separatism. You shun connection, you shun worldliness. And Cantor says it's pretty nihilistic too, because people just accept forces of oppression, indignity, and violence as given, and there's nothing you can do about it. He says the worst examples of this in modern times are terrorists, but I would add those who characterize whole categories of people as evil. So that was the evil worldview. The next one is almost the polar opposite, the life-giving worldview. This is a world essentially life-giving and nourishing. Cantor says, filled with responsibility and grace. This worldview suggests a benevolent, loving God with this grand plan. It's a theology about God the Creator using the universe to ever so slowly create a better world, a utopia. It's as if they're trying to bring the concept of a traditional heaven down to earth. It's the believer's responsibility then, because they have these deep feelings of gratitude for having been created, to help carry it out, to help co-create this utopia on earth. So some of the examples that Cantor cites that I was also thinking about are a lot of the Catholic charities that you see, or other Christian groups that spend a lot of time and energy and effort caring for the historically marginalized and underprivileged. And then all of this is done because of a belief that God, through the Christ, has called his believers into discipleship. Cantor says it's the idea that you see Christ or God in the people that you're helping, and it all is connected in this co-creating idea. The last worldview that Cantor brings up is indifference. The world is just a bunch of molecular and chemical processes. It's amoral. It's sort of like it's a bunch of muck that has neither evil nor benevolent intent. Kendra says this would be the classic secular unbelieving view. He said, well, we frankly all just exist to add our DNA to the universal melting pot, and then we go away. It's clearly very nihilistic. But then he said there's also another way to interpret this indifferent world view. He says it's also basically a statement of faith. And he said that most progressive religious people, and I would add religious humanists to this, see it as a statement of faith that the indifferent world needs our attention. The concept here is that human beings are the consciousness of the world. It's bend towards goals as such as justice and peace. So those of you that have been around Unitarian Universalism for a while probably recognize those words, bend towards goals such as justice as peace, from Theodore Parker, are basically the godfather of Unitarian social justice in the United States. Theodore Parker said that the moral arc of the universe ultimately bends towards justice, a quote that's been reused by President Abraham Lincoln, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and President Barack Obama, as well as others. Well, many of the Unitarian Universalists I know are strongly, strongly committed to this last worldview. I guess I'd call it indifference with agency, right? We tend to be a very rational faith. We're a people that are in our head an awful lot and try to think things through. It has to make sense. Many would say we're science-based, that you have to prove something before I'm going to believe it. We don't use a lot of supernatural terms in the way we speak of our faith, except when we're using really grand and well-thought-out metaphors, then we use a lot of them. But it essentially tends to also be a faith based on experience. There's a lot of you, as in every Unitarian Universalist congregation I've ever been involved with, that are always involved in organizations and efforts to bend this world towards justice and peace. And lately, the question seems to continue to be asked, why do we continue to do this? Why do we continue to do what we do, even when the global trends are kind of going back towards this worldview of evil and this big struggle and every person for themselves? I've been asking a lot of people that, and I asked a close friend recently who's very involved in the community what he thought, and he said, I do it because I've seen what can happen when diverse people work together for the common good. When they come together in love and care for each other, it can be miraculous. We don't talk about miracles much, but in that context, yes. In this world context, in this pandemic, when people come together in love and care for each other, it is a miracle. And he said his lived experience makes him extremely loyal to this manifestation of faith, even though if you asked him specifics like doctrine and does it believe in God and that kind of thing, through many of those traditional measures, he would be counted as an unbeliever. So it's for this same reason that I became Unitarian Universalist, ultimately a minister, and remain loyally so. So last Sunday, I preached this sermon with my congregations. It was Easter Sunday, and we're still in the Easter season, so bear with me. I'm going to do a little Easter reference here to close out. So the question would be, why do Unitarian Universalists recall the Christian story of Jesus' resurrection on Easter Sunday? According to the faith of my mother and aunt, we have no right to the story because we don't believe in the concept of a divine creature needing to suffer a brutal death and then be resurrected in order to save a place for us in an eternal paradise. Rather, we believe in the humanity of Jesus, that through the stories of his really short time on this earth, we had a glimpse of how a human being could have the audacious faith that he could bend the world towards justice and peace. My friends, it's that concept that we resurrect every Easter. It's this miraculous story of the seemingly impossible that we continue to be loyal to. It's even how we unbelievers reclaim faith. And may this faith bless us all. Amen.